So last week I spent time on part of a passage from Ephesians 4 that has to do with that interesting statement that says, be angry and do not sin. So we're going to be talking, sort of unpacking that a little bit more. And I'm going to revisit just a few more things so that we're all together on the same page. So I hope I didn't make anybody angry last week talking about anger, but, you know, you got to be faithful to the scripture, so you got to do what you got to do. So, I wanted to amplify a little bit. Something I said that I did not intend to say last week was the emphasis I put on how anger was so much a part of the origin of the whole creation and the origin of humanity altogether. That anger has played a prominent part throughout the history of humanity and throughout our relationship with God. So, for example, if you wanted to turn to, we're going to go to some Bible verses today. So, if you want to turn to Isaiah chapter 14 in your Bibles, we read here where Satan has this rebellious anger and suffers judgment as a result of that. And this is one of the primary texts that helps us to understand what happened between God and Satan. Now, I want to say that anger is implied in this text, but typically when there's rebellion, there's usually anger, right? It's hard to be rebellious without being angry. So I think this is a fair text to include. So what I'm saying to you is the problems that have visited man because of the fall go all the way back to God and his relationship with Satan and Satan's angry rebellion to God. And you can see then that from the very beginning, anger has been a constant and regular theme in all of the relationships that have been created. All right? So here we are in Isaiah 14, beginning with verse 12. How you have fallen from heaven, O day star, son of dawn. This is a reference to Satan. How you are cut down to the ground, you who laid the nations low. You said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven above the stars of God. I will set my throne on high. I will sit on the mount of assembly in the far reaches of the north. So he's basically saying, I'm going to have a throne, a place even greater than that of God. Right? So Isaiah is describing Satan's attitude in this regard. Verse 14. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. How many of you are familiar with this text? Have you ever read it before? It's interesting, isn't it? Verse 15. But you are brought down to Sheol, that is to hell, to the far reaches of the pit. And so because Satan was not satisfied with who he was and wanted to be like God, he rebelled, and as he rebelled, he was cast down into the pit, into hell, Sheol. And so this anger thing, this rebellious thing, was a part of, from the very beginning, was a part of all relationships. Then I mentioned Cain and Abel. From Genesis chapter 4. And you will recall in Genesis chapter 4, if you want to turn to that as well, God created Adam and Eve, and Adam and Eve had Cain and Abel, and Cain wanted to offer a sacrifice, and Abel offered a sacrifice, and Abel offered the sacrifice the best portions. Cain just made a sacrifice of whatever it was that he had. He patronized God, and so as a result of that, Abel's sacrifice was accepted and Cain's was not. And so we pick it up here in Genesis 4:5. But for Cain and his offering, that is, God had no regard. So Cain was very angry. And then verse 8. Because he was angry, Cain spoke to Abel, his brother. Said there was some premeditation here, right? Cain spoke to his Abel brother, and when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel, and he killed him. So here we have Adam and Eve, and only one generation later from Adam and Eve, you have this anger thing that's significant enough that one brother kills another brother because of jealousy, because Abel had something that he did not. Satan rebelled because God had something that he did not. And usually when we're angry at somebody, they have something that we don't have. And unless we come to terms with it, it becomes cancerous to us. So we have this interesting, problematic text, be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger and give opportunity to the devil. Ephesians 4, 26 and 27. Be angry and do not sin, and then contextually, do not let the sun go down on your anger and give no opportunity for the devil. So we'll just talk about that for a few minutes. So what does it mean? Is it possible to be angry and yet not sin? We'll talk about that in a little bit. Do not let the sun go down on your anger. And so practically speaking, he's saying don't let anger develop deep roots. Hold short accounts. If you are angry with someone, resolve it as soon as you possibly can. It's not always possible. So I know that when my wife and I first got married, we tried to keep short accounts particularly. And so we would always try to fix something before we went to bed, you know. Well, sometimes that's not always possible. Sometimes you need to sleep on something a night or two or even a week before it can. You have the perspective and you have the patience to really deal with that. But as a rule of thumb, and that's how this is supposed to be interpreted, as a rule of thumb, you keep short accounts with other people who have made you angry. You try to resolve it as quickly as you possibly can. Because if you don't, then that thing that made you angry begins to grow roots, and those roots go deeper and deeper, and the deeper the roots go, the more you kind of build your life around that thing or that person that made you angry. And when you build your life around something, you begin to have habits. You change your structures, all that kind of stuff around what made you angry. And so now, if you're going to fix that anger, you have to change the structures, you have to change the habits, you have to go back and do all that stuff over. Does this make sense to you? So as a rule of thumb, it's always very good to try and resolve your anger as soon as you can. And to do it humbly. If you want to keep a short account with somebody, it doesn't mean then that you patronize them. Hey, look, I'm trying to keep short accounts, so let's talk this thing through and get it done. That's not how you do it. I think there's a degree of humility there. There's a degree of intellectual honesty. There's an openness to ways in which you might have been complicit in why that person became angry in the first place. There's some give and take on those kinds of things. Now, here's an interesting thing, and I think this should raise the concern even more, because when we look at Revelation chapter 12, if you want to turn to your Bibles in that, Revelation chapter 12, verses 7 through 12. Revelation 12, verses 7 through 12. And so this is the great vision that the Apostle John had at the end of his life while he was on the island of Patmos. And he records this vision in this manner. So beginning in Revelation 12, I'm going to pick it up at verse 10. And he says, "Then I heard a loud voice in heaven proclaiming, 'Now have come the salvation and the power of the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Messiah. For the accuser, that is Satan, of our comrades has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God.'" So Satan originally was cast down into hell, and now he is cast down again because, as we're going to read here, because of the work of Christ on the cross. But he describes him as the accuser, that Satan that when we are judged before God, there's a certain sense in which Satan accuses us of our sin. See, they did these things. Now you must judge them in the same way you judged me. Verse 11, but they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, for they did not cling to life or even in the face of death. Verse 12, rejoice then, you heavens, and those who dwell in them. But woe to the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you with great wrath, because he knows his time is short. So the second most powerful entity that has ever been created is angry at us. And in his anger has devised plans of anger and uses anger to make his plans come to fruition. So anger then isn't something that we should regard in a half-hearted manner. Anger is something that is a constant theme that runs through the history of humanity with regularity and with powerful effect. And it does that because the players who are involved, both Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel and Satan himself, have made that a very poignant thing in the very DNA of who we are and the spirituality of who we are. So anger should be paid attention to. And so we have to be very, very careful. And so we have to deal with it in the way that Christ would want us to deal with it. So what does it mean then to be angry and yet do not sin? How can we be angry? And so maybe, and are there things that we can be angry about? Well, sure. I mean, there are all kinds of things that happen in this world that are unjust. And those unjust things are deserving of righteous indignation and anger. But we have to be very careful then how we, you know, that we don't go too far with that. And so so just by way of example, anger drives so much of our everyday activity in our lives. If you think about it, and profoundly shapes the culture around us. So, for example, anger influences how we feel about ourselves, our physical and emotional well-being. Anger influences that. It can. Anger can influence who our friends can and cannot be. If you don't believe me, just talk to the average middle school kid. Who hates who, why they hate them, why they can't be friends, who said what, why they said what they said. And then, you know, we do this in more a more civilized adult fashion normally, but we do the same kinds of things. Anger influences who we might relate to in terms of our immediate relatives and in-laws. I mean, isn't it interesting that we can have phenomenal relationships with second and third cousins, but our in-laws or our brother or our sister we can't relate to because of something they said or something they did, we haven't been able to forgive them. They made us angry, or we made them angry in some fashion. Anger influences primary relationships in our lives on a regular basis. Anger relates to our neighbors. You know, there's this old saying, fences make for good neighbors, right? You ever hear that? Because, you know, when your kids are playing ball, can't go over into their yard because going into the yard is like a capital crime or something like that. You know, there are all these things that happen. Your dog goes to the bathroom in their yard when you weren't looking, and people just get really angry about all this stuff, and they get so infuriated. But anger has a way of influencing who will be neighborly and who will not, and how you can live next to somebody for 30 or 40 years and hardly speak to them. We had a guy when I lived in Washington, PA. I was a small kid, and I remember we had a neighbor. His name was Mr. Bedillion, and he was just mean. He was angry, and he was mean. And one day, our dog, we had a German Shepherd, came, I mean, was screaming, came to the back door, and just threw itself at the door. We let it in. She ran downstairs into the basement, crawled into a corner, and died. He fed her rat poison. Just because. If a ball went over into his yard, never got it back. He was just a mean person. I don't know what made him mean. His wife was as sweet as can be. She died. He had a daughter who never got married, and he abused her. Just abused her. So, you know, what goes on in a person's life that they can't resolve this anger, this inner rage that they have? And as a result, we never spoke to him. I mean, for all the years that we lived there, he had no desire to ever speak to us. Anger relates how we treat and relate to coworkers, does it not? I mean, there are some coworkers you get along with and some you don't. Some that you're really frustrated with because they play those inner office political games, they gossip, they do all that stuff. And so, if you've ever worked in an office, a complex or whatever, you know this stuff is alive and well all the time. In fact, in order to deal with it, we devise things like professionalism. I don't care if you're mad at this person or not, you have to be professional about how you deal with this person or this situation with this person or whatever. Your commitment to the business has to transcend your personal opinion about that person. That's a relatively new invention in the corporate world, this insistence on professionalism, because of how people let personal relationships interfere with things like that. Anger gets in the way of things like job advancement, job demotions, leaving a job, or loss of employment. Anger has a lot to do with those kinds of things as well. Anger has a lot to do with the quality and the permanency of marriage. So I've covered the waterfront here, at least personally, don't you think? And everybody would agree with me that anger influences all these things, does it not? Culturally speaking, anger is responsible for much of the film and music and art that we produce. There's a lot of stuff that's produced out there just because someone's mad. Anger is responsible for the creation of many of the laws that we pass legislatively. It's what drives them, and some of that can be righteous anger. When a corporation does something that impacts or a group of people without their knowing, like pollution or something like that, then it's right to be angry about that. Anger has a lot to do, this will probably surprise you, but anger has a lot to do with how political parties regard and relate to each other. I know, I'm reaching here, but I thought maybe you might have seen something out there similar to this. It's astounding that we have a two-party system that's basically non-functioning. Anger influences domestic law and policies. Anger influences international policy. From trade to war itself, anger influences all of those things. So in case anybody here thinks that anger is not an issue, I've just shown you that it touches every possible component of our life. And how much better our lives might be if we appreciated the significance of the role that anger plays and how more Christ-likeness could influence a better world as opposed to anger. So, for example, in social media, it's just an observation, but there seems to be an addiction to a culture of rage. Everyone's offended. That's exactly right. But there seems to be an addiction to it, right? And sometimes, especially among certain groups of people, it's often mistaken for being relevant and having purpose and meaning. Like, if I'm angry about this particular thing, then I'm relevant. If I'm not angry, then I'm irrelevant. Now, think about that for just a second. If I'm angry about it, I'm relevant. If I'm not angry, then I'm irrelevant. So, anger then in our culture is used to authenticate a person's purpose. It would appear that meaning in life for some is subjectively validated by attaching one's perceived purpose to some kind of cultural rage. In other words, it's the purest form of virtue signaling. In other words, if I think this is my calling and it's not, and this thing that that concerns me is not getting done, the only way that I can convince you that I think this is significant and valid is if you see me angry about it. If I'm angry about it, then it validates it. It makes it significant. If I'm not angry, if I just want to talk about it, then it's just not important. We have this culture of rage that we've given a lot of people permission to exercise. And it's very destructive. I'll give you an example of that. That group Antifa would be exactly what I'm talking about. It's a culture of rage. They would say to you, we are exercising righteous anger. And so millions of dollars later, broken bodies, all that kind of stuff, they've exercised righteous anger. But they feel important. They feel relevant. They feel validated. And their anger has helped them to do that. Let me just say this to you. There are very few things more dangerous than a false sense of righteous anger. So if we're going to be angry and not sin, if we're going to have an anger that's righteous, we better make sure that anger truly is righteous, that it's about something that really is grievous to God. If it's a false sense of righteousness, it's a very, very dangerous thing. You can justify almost anything you want to with a false sense of righteous anger. So make sure that what you are angry about is a righteous cause and or a violation of some eternal principle. Now, John Calvin says this. I got this from Ligonier Ministries. I thought it was very helpful and interesting. He says, it is exceedingly rare for human anger not to transgress God's will. Commenting on Ephesians 4, John Calvin lists three ways in which anger can be sinful. The first is when our anger arises from slight causes and often from no cause whatsoever, or at least from private offenses. A short temper that refuses to overlook minor flaws manifests sinful anger. You know, I used to see this, particularly when I worked in a steel mill as a college student, how many of the men there would fly off the handle at the smallest thing. It was really amazing. And since then, and I don't know if you know people like that, but usually you walk on eggshells around them. I mean, you're concerned that if you say something or do something, the slightest little provocation, they're just going to, go postal on you, right? And what triggers that? Why does that person get so angry so easily? Why do they get offended so easily? Why can they not see certain things about themselves that are worthy of being critical of, but without demeaning them? But they get angry, they get defensive. And so he's saying here that there are people who get angry over slight causes. So when you get angry, do you get angry over only the big issues? Or do you get angry over things that are really pretty insignificant in the whole scheme of things? You remember I asked you this past week to think about ways in which you get angry, you would lose your temper or whatever.
Now, I told you, there are two things. I hate to hit my head, and I hate to drop stuff. And so those would be slight things that make me angry. It's true. So this week, when I hit my head a couple times and dropped some things, I tried hard not to get angry because I thought, well, this is an example of that. And then, did you ever get angry and you thought nobody was around, right? And you're doing the Yosemite Sam thing. You're stomping up and down and throwing your hat down and like, ooh, and you get real, you know what I'm saying? You remember Yosemite Sam on the cartoon thing, right? And how he'd lose his temper. And then you look up and you see this person looking at you like you've lost your mind, Like, oh, no, it's one of those things. So control the slight things that make you angry. Number two, he says, our anger is also sinful when we go beyond the proper bounds and are hurried into intemperate excesses. Fallen anger, not righteous wrath, is disproportionate to the degree of offense. So sometimes we get angry, right? And we get overly angry than what the situation demands. I mean, certainly there was some kind of offense. Certainly something happened that inconvenienced you or that embarrassed you or whatever. But the degree with which you lost your anger was way more than what that really deserved. Right? And so we do that too sometimes. And when we do, there's usually something deeper going on. There's usually something more that's really happening. And we have to come to terms with that. So there's usually a reservoir there, and that thing that happened, just let a little of that out, and we have to come to terms with that. So do we get excessively angry over something that doesn't deserve that kind of excessive anger? So, if a terrorist were to send the United States a note saying, we're going to bomb you, and the United States sent a nuclear bomb over and eliminated about 1 million people, would that be excessive? Yeah, well, of course it would be excessive. So I'm saying in an excessive sort of way, that's what I'm talking about. You have to keep whatever you're angry about, if it's a righteous anger, if it's a good anger, commensurate to the circumstances. You have to do that. Otherwise, it's too much. Third, he says, finally, we sin when our anger, which ought to have been directed against ourselves or against sins, is turned against our brethren. Let us not get mad at the speck in another's eye, but ignore the log in our own. And so sometimes, I'll get frustrated with my performance or something that I did or didn't do, And so I should have been angry at myself, but instead I took my anger out on someone else. So, you ever see that where you get yelled at by the boss at work? So you come home and you yell at your kid, and your kid kicks the dog, and your dog goes and bites a neighbor. That's kind of like what happens a lot of times, right? We have to come to terms with our own anger and not take it out on other people. I do want to say this, because I want to get this in, but I want to say just a couple more things. There are other words for anger. So I think it's important to look at these. For example, annoyed would be a word. It's kind of a shallow kind of anger. Irritation would be a bit more than the word annoyed. Resentment, right? Where you're angry at a person for what they did. A grudge, which would be more than just resentment, because a grudge usually implies a withholding of something, a hanging on. Rage. And then malice. Rage is just like when you lose your temper, right? Malice implies some kind of evil intent motivated by anger, right? So let's just drill down on this a little bit more. What are some contributing causes to anger? The wiring. So my dad had a temper problem. My mother did not. And sometimes I can be my dad, but most of the time I'm my mother. But there's wiring there that's involved. Environment, how you were raised or the environment that you work in or live in can have a lot to do with anger. Situational, which means things like emotional burnout. Normally you're fine, but circumstances being what they are, you're just burned out on something particular, and so you lose anger, you become enraged, whatever. Physical fatigue. If you're tired, you get angry more easily or less easily? More easily, right? I'm that way. I tend to lose, if I lose my temper, it's because I'm really, really tired. Look at this. Anger can be a highly toxic gateway emotion to all kinds of destructive behavior. It's a gateway emotion. It's an emotion that allows you to do other kinds of things that you would not normally do. And that's why it's so important to pay attention to. And as such, it's responsible for relational alienation, damage and destruction, individual emotion and psychological damage, individual and or corporate physical violence and death. Anger is the gateway to all of that stuff. It's the gateway to all of this. If you control your anger, you can take that off the board normally. It's that significant. Unresolved anger leads to bitterness, bitterness to hate, and hate to malice, and even despair. Unresolved anger can lead to bitterness. Do you like being around a bitter person? I do not. Bitterness leads to hate. Do you like being around hateful people? It's ugly, isn't it? And then do you like being around people who are actively working to hurt another person because of their anger? Absolutely not. But here's another thing. Malice can lead to despair. Malice can lead to despair. And when you despair, despair is when anger is exhausted. And when anger is exhausted, there's no ability for faith, hope, and love. When anger is exhausted and you enter into despair, then you cannot experience faith, hope, and love. And that is exactly where the enemy wants us, to despair, so that we cannot trust in faith, we cannot trust in hope, and we cannot trust in love. It's that significant. It plays that much of a role. So, in closing, let me just say, this week, use this week to study your anger. What makes you angry? Why? And how can you replace that anger with the person of Christ? So in the earlier call to worship, how do we take on the fruits of the Spirit? Because remember, the things that the Apostle Paul says, he says, you know, these things, if you exercise these things, you cannot enter into the kingdom of God. And so, and most of those things are oriented around anger. He says, the acts of the flesh are obvious, sexual immorality, impurity, and debauchery, idolatry, and witchcraft. The other half or more has to do with anger. Hatred, discord, jealousy, fits of rage, selfish ambition, dissensions, factions, and envy, drunkenness, and orgies, and the like. I warn you, as I did before, that those who live like this will not inherit the kingdom of God. Instead, you got to live by the fruit of the Spirit, which is love, joy, peace, forbearance, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, and gentleness, and self-control. And against such things there is no law. We have to replace the things that cause anger in our life with the fruit of the Spirit, because the fruit of the Spirit is the very essence of Christ himself. So anger is that important. And we have to come to terms with the anger that we have in our lives. I don't know where anybody, I mean, I don't know where all of us are and that kind of a thing. I just know that there is this interesting dynamic that we are given permission to be angry about unjust things. But if we do, we have to be careful that we do not sin and give the devil opportunity. So unresolved anger gives the devil opportunity for sin.